From Pacifica, this is Democracy Now!
When we turn on the television, somebody is providing us a mirror to the world. And what we want is that mirror to reflect the reality of ordinary people and not the illusions of a few.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. He's the first socialist elected to the U.S. Senate. As President Bush prepares to give his State of the Union address, we'll hear Senator Sanders' assessment of that union. Then we'll speak with a woman who has covered dozens of State of the Union addresses, a conversation with the First Lady of the Press, veteran White House correspondent Helen Thomas on journalism and war.
I honestly believe that if the press had really said, why, give us the proof, and that Congress, too, Congress rolled over and played dead as well. I honestly believe that there might have been a chance to avoid this debacle.
Helen Thomas and Bernie Sanders, all that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. In Iraq, at least 78 people have died today in a pair of nearly simultaneous explosions. The bombs hit a predominantly Shia commercial area in Baghdad. Over 150 people were also injured. This marks the second large bombing attack in Baghdad in less than a week. On Saturday, 25 U.S. troops died, making it the third deadliest day of the war for the United States. 12 of the troops were killed when their Black Hawk helicopter crashed. Eyewitnesses said the helicopter was shot down. Another 5 U.S. troops died inside a government compound in the Shia city of Karbala when they were attacked by Iraqi fighters disguised as U.S. soldiers. Meanwhile, President Bush's escalation of the war has already begun, despite opposition from many lawmakers on Capitol Hill. 3,200 more U.S. soldiers arrived in Baghdad Sunday. This is Democratic Senator Edward Kennedy.
And I must say, if we have a president that is going to effectively defy the American people, going to defy the generals, defy the majority of the Congress, the United States, in Republicans and Democrats, then we, I think, have a responsibility to end the funding for that, for the war.
President Bush is expected to defend the escalation of the war during the State of the Union address Tuesday night. Meanwhile, Republican Senator John McCain criticized a non-binding Senate resolution opposing the president's plan to send 20,000 more troops to Iraq.
This resolution is basically a vote of no confidence in the men and women we are sending over there. We're saying, we're sending you, we're not going to stop you from going there, but we don't believe you can succeed. And we're not willing to support that. I don't think the troops would find that an expression of support.
President Bush has said he plans to escalate the war in Iraq regardless of what action Congress takes. However, 21 legal scholars have written a letter to the House and Senate leadership to argue that Congress has the constitutional power to limit the scope of war. According to the scholars, Congress has the power to cap the number of soldiers sent to fight and to limit the use of appropriated funds. Meanwhile, the new Pentagon statistics show Iraq war is now costing $8.4 billion a month, nearly twice what it cost during the first year of fighting. Arrangements are being made in Ohio for the funeral of Andrea Parhamovich. She is the 28-year-old American civilian killed last week in Baghdad while working for the National Democratic Institute. A former top State Department official is warning the Bush administration has drawn up plans for a broad attack against Iran. The official, Wayne White, said, quote, "I've seen some of the planning. You're not talking about a surgical strike." Up until 2005, White was a top Middle East analyst for the State Department's Bureau of Intelligence Research. White predicted a war against Iran would likely destabilize the Middle East for years. On Sunday, former Pentagon advisor Richard Perle said President Bush will order an attack on Iran if it becomes clear to him that Iran is set to acquire a nuclear weapons capability. Pearl's comments came during a conference in Israel. In other news on Iran, former Secretary of State Colin Powell's chief of staff has revealed that Vice President Dick Cheney rejected an Iranian offer in 2003 to help the United States stabilize Iraq. According to Lawrence Wilkerson, Tehran also offered to end its military support for Hezbollah and Hamas. A 10-year-old Palestinian girl has died after being shot in the back of the head by Israeli troops in the West Bank town of Anata. The girl, Abir Aramin, was shot Friday while she was outside her school on recess. Her father, Bassam Aramin, helped found Combatants for Peace, a group of former Israeli and Palestinian fighters. Aramin said his daughter's death will not deter him from trying to work for peace. He said, quote, "We have no choice but to continue to save more children from falling in this dirty conflict." In other news from the region, the Israeli Defense Forces have admitted that it lied last week when it said that 44 dirt obstacles had been removed from around West Bank villages. In fact, the obstacles did not actually exist. The IDF made the announcement in an attempt to fulfill a promise of Prime Minister Ehud Olmert to ease the lives of Palestinian civilians. In Turkey, one of the country's most prominent Turkish-American newspaper editors, Hrant Dink, has been murdered. He was shot outside his office Friday. He had recently received death threats by Turkish nationalists for his writings about the Armenian genocide of 1915. Seven suspects have been arrested, including a 17-year-old who was reportedly confessed. Police officials have said a well-known nationalist militant has admitted he provided a gun and money to the teenager. In political news, Democratic Senator Hillary Clinton, Republican Senator Sam Brownback, and New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson have all announced plans to run for president. Richardson's trying to become the first Latino president. Senator Clinton made her announcement in a video message on her website.
I announced today that I'm forming a presidential exploratory committee. I'm not just starting a campaign, though. I'm beginning a conversation with you, with America, because we all need to be part of the discussion if we're all going to be part of the solution.
Barack Obama announced his intentions last week. Former Republican Congressmember Bob Ney has been sentenced to 30 months in prison for lying about his dealings with convicted Republican lobbyist Jack Abramoff. For years, Ney traded his political influence for gifts, vacations, campaign contributions, and in one case, $50,000 in gambling chips. In environmental news, executives from nine major U.S. corporations have launched an unprecedented campaign to call on the federal government to step up efforts to fight global warming. Companies involved include General Electric, DuPont, Alcoa, Lehman Brothers, and Caterpillar. Meanwhile, a new United Nations report on climate change predicts the rate of global warming over the next quarter of a century will be twice that of the previous century. The forthcoming UN report concludes most of the global warming since the middle of the last century has been caused by man-made greenhouse gases. A series of protests and vigils are scheduled today in Washington to mark the 34th anniversary of the Supreme Court's Roe v. Wade decision, which legalized abortion. The National Organization for Women is holding a candlelight vigil outside the Supreme Court. Opponents of a woman's right to choose are holding their annual March for Life. President Bush is expected to call to address the marchers. Lawmakers in North Carolina are calling on the state's attorney general to investigate the charter plane company, Aero Contractors. The North Carolina-based firm has provided Gulfstream jets to the CIA for use in its secretive extraordinary rendition program. Aero Contractors was founded by a CIA officer who once flew planes for the CIA's Air America fleet. The American Civil Liberties Union sued Aero Contractors last year for transporting the German citizen Khaled al-Masri after he was seized by U.S. agents in Macedonia. The U.S. military's new rules for trying prisoners at Guantanamo Bay are coming under intense criticism from within the military. Dwight Sullivan, the Pentagon's chief defense counsel, said the rules appear carefully crafted to ensure that an accused can be convicted and possibly executed based on nothing but a coerced confession. In Pennsylvania, Secret Service agents questioned an 81-year-old man Thursday after he wrote a letter to the editor criticizing Saddam Hussein's execution. In the letter, Dan Tilley wrote, quote, "They hanged the wrong man." The Secret Service agents searched his house and took photos of him before deciding he was not a threat. And more than 80,000 people are gathering in Kenya this week for the 7th annual World Social Forum. The theme of the meeting is people's struggles, people's alternatives, another world is possible. On Saturday, the World Social Forum began with a march through the Kenyan capital of Nairobi. This is Kenyan activist Joseph Ole Simmel.
The importance of the World Social Forum is to give a voice to those who do not have a voice and say, yes, it's true. Even those people in Switzerland are saying, this is a world we want to create. This is a world that must be there. We're also saying another world is possible, a world where social justice, where equity, right, are going to be exercised.
The World Social Forum is taking place just ahead of the World Economic Forum, which opens Tuesday in Davos, Switzerland. This is Kenyan peace activist Beatrice Njau.
We are telling the world, and especially the rich people in America, all over, instead of fighting and buying arms, can they bring food and water, clean water, to the women in the village and even in the slums?
South African Archbishop Desmond Tutu and Kenyan environmentalist Wangari Maathai said 40 million Africans have died in recent years, in part because African governments have failed to fulfill promises to spend at least 15% of national budgets on health care. Desmond Tutu also called for debt relief for African nations.
Maybe there are no tangible achievements, but surely the most important is being able to have placed certain items on the agenda and saying to the world, you are not going to get away and pretend that there is no poverty, pretend that the economic order is a just one, pretend that the debts that so many countries are carrying are equitable debts.
That is Bishop Desmond Tutu. He and Wangari Maathai, the Kenyan environmentalist, both attending the World Social Forum, have won the Nobel Peace Prize. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. Tomorrow night, President Bush will give a seventh State of the Union address before a joint session of Congress. Last weekend, Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders gave what could be described as an alternate State of the Union before thousands of people gathered in Memphis, Tennessee, for the third National Conference for Media Reform. Sanders is the independent who was elected to the Senate in November of 2006. He's the country's first self-described socialist to be elected to the U.S. Senate. Before becoming senator, Bernie Sanders served in the House of Representatives for 15 years, where he was the longest-serving independent in modern history. This is Bernie Sanders speaking at the National Conference for Media Reform.
We have already taken a giant step forward in transforming our country, because what we have done and the size of this conference indicates our success. We have begun the long road to make media a major political issue in America. And more in campaigns and in non-campaigns, when people who are running for office go before the public, and as Ben mentioned, when they talk about health care or the environment or the dozens of other important issues, somebody in the front of the room is going to raise their hand and say, well, what do you think about corporate control over the media? What are you going to do about that? So to the degree that we have already raised consciousness on this issue, we should be very proud. But obviously, we know that we still have a very, very long way to go. I happen to believe that we are reaching a moment when critical mass is kicking in. Because of your efforts, because of a growing grassroots movement all over America, what I can tell you is that not only in the House is there a media caucus where this issue is now going to reach a higher level than ever before, I can tell you that it's going to happen in the Senate as well. I can also tell you, absolutely, that we will not succeed unless you are there, unless there is a strong grassroots media which demands fundamental changes in media today and the end of corporate control over our media. We've got to work together on that. Now, you are going to hear from a lot of folks who know more about the details of the media than I do. But what I do know a lot about is how media impacts the political process, what media means for those of us who day after day struggle with the major issues facing our country, and a goal of trying to improve the quality of life for all of our people. And I want to spend just a minute in telling you what I suspect most of you already know. If you are concerned, as Ben said, about health care, if you are concerned about foreign policy and Iraq, if you are concerned about the economy, if you are concerned about global warming, you are kidding yourselves if you are not concerned about corporate control over the media, because every one of these issues is directly controlled and directly relevant to the media. Let me just talk about a few. 4 years ago, George W. Bush told the American people that a third-rate military power, country called Iraq, had weapons of mass destruction and that they were about to attack the United States of America. That's what he told us. I can tell you, because I was there in the middle of that, in opposition to that, that day after day, those of us who oppose the war, among many other things, would be holding national press conferences that you never saw. I can tell you, as you know, that hundreds of thousands of people in our country were so disgusted with the media simply acting as a megaphone for the president that they turned off American media and they went to the BBC or the Canadian Broadcasting Corporation. In terms of the war in Iraq, the American media failed and failed grotesquely in exposing the dishonest and misleading assertions of the Bush administration in the lead up to that war. And they are as responsible as is President Bush for the disaster that now befalls us. Media plays a role, and the disintegration of Iraq, the death of hundreds of thousands of Iraqis, of over 3,000 Americans, the cost of hundreds of billions of dollars out of our pockets, directly related to the failure of the media. Let me touch on another issue, an issue that I am deeply involved in. If you were to ask me what the most significant untold story of our time is in terms of domestic politics, I would tell you very simply that that story happens to be the collapse of the American middle class. Simply stated, I don't want to speak at great length on it, but simply stated, despite an explosion of technology, huge increase in worker productivity, tens of millions of our fellow Americans have seen a decline in their real wages and are working longer hours for lower wages. In fact, what you probably don't know is that the working people in our country work longer hours than do the working people in any other industrialized nation on Earth. How did that happen? How did it happen today that a two-income family has less disposable income than a one-income family did 30 years ago? How does it happen that 30 years ago, one person working 40 hours a week could earn enough money to take care of the family? Now you need two, and they're still not doing it. Now, one might think that this is an interesting story, one might think that globalization and disastrous trade policies, which have lowered the standard of living of millions of American workers, might be a story that should be covered. What I can tell you is that when NAFTA was first passed over 10 years ago, and I strongly opposed NAFTA, we did some research. We went through the editorial pages of every major newspaper in America. Every single one of them was pro-NAFTA. And today, despite a $600 billion trade deficit, the loss of millions of good-paying blue-collar and white-collar jobs, these corporate titans are still in favor of unfettered free trade, despite the disastrous impact it has had on America's workers. Now, what is all of this about? What happens if the reality of working people's lives are not reflected in the TV, in the newspapers? What happens? This is what happens. People lose their jobs because corporations shut down. Just had an instance in Vermont this week. 175 workers shut down, lost their jobs because of free trade. People working long hours, people working for lower wages. They turn on the television set, they do not see that reality. What they see is the issue is personal responsibility. You can't afford health care, you're losing your pension, then the problem is with you, work a little bit harder. It is not a systemic problem. It is not a problem that can be solved by government. It is not a problem which asked you to be involved in the political process. You are the only person who can't find a job that pays you a living wage. That's your fault. And you are the only person who can't find the job that provides you with health care. That's your fault. And you're the only father who can't afford to send your kid to college. That's your fault. Don't get involved in the political process. It won't do any good. So people turn on the television, they are hurting, they're exhausted. They do not see a reflection of their reality in the media. They do not understand that participation in the political process can bring about change, and that is not by accident. When we wake up in the morning and we brush our teeth, for better or worse, we see our own reflections in the mirror. When we turn on the television, somebody is providing us a mirror to the world. And what we want is that mirror to reflect the reality of ordinary people and not the illusions of a few.
More with Independent Senator Bernie Sanders after break.
They used to tell me I was building a dream. So I followed them all. When there was wheat to plow, all guns to bear, I was always there, right on the job. They used to tell me I was building a dream with peace and glory ahead. Why should I be standing in this line waiting?
Dr. John singing Yip Harburg's Brother, Can You Spare a Dime? This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we return to the Vermont Independent, Senator Bernie Sanders speaking at the National Conference for Media Reform in Memphis, Tennessee.
Talk about health care. We are told, and it is quite amazing, after 16 years in the Congress, you hear these guys getting up on the floor of the House, we have the best healthcare system in the world. Yeah. 47 million Americans have no health insurance, even more underinsured. We pay the highest prices in the world for prescription drugs. Costs are soaring. Best healthcare system in the world. But you know, go out on the street and ask people how many major countries in the world do not have a national health care program which guarantees health care to all people. And you know what? Most people do not know, because they have not seen it reflected in the media, that the United States of America is the only nation on earth that does not guarantee health care to all of its people. They do not know about the healthcare systems in Scandinavia. They do not know about European healthcare systems. And the only thing they will hear about the Canadian healthcare system are the problems that that system has. That's what they will hear. I can remember in the early 1990s, during the early years of the Clinton administration, there was a lot of debate about the need for real healthcare reform. Do you happen to know which piece of legislation in the House had far more support than any other concept? You probably don't. It was legislation to support a single-payer national health care system. That's a fact. But, as somebody who was involved in that fight, we would turn on the television and say, hey, single-payer has more support than any other concept. Are you going to talk about single payer? Oh, no, we don't talk about single payer. It's not feasible. Virtually no coverage about what a single payer concept is about. Virtually no coverage about international health care and how other countries are doing a better job than we are doing. In terms of the environment, if we are told over and over again that there is a serious scientific debate about the causation of global warming or whether global warming actually exists, it has an impact upon our consciousness. Why should we break our dependency on fossil fuels? Why should we move to sustainable energy if there is a debate among the scientific community? And that is, in fact, what you hear in the media. Well, you know what? There is no debate among the scientific community. Now, here's an issue that I'm sure you see on the TV almost every night. It probably bores you, you see it so much. And that is that the United States today has the most unfair distribution of wealth and income of any major country on earth. I was joking. You don't see that on television very often. Now, here is an issue, you know, which is of enormous significance from an economic point of view, as well as a political point of view, as well as a moral point of view. Richest 1% of the population in America owns more wealth than the bottom 90%. Richest 13,000 families earn more income than do the bottom 20 million families. In many ways, in my view, we are moving toward an oligarchic form of society. Do you think that maybe this is an issue that should be thrown out there on the table? Do we think it's a good idea that so few have so much and so many have so little? But that is an issue that is beyond the scope of what establishment media is literally allowed to discuss. Now, I have been in politics for a long time. I have been asked 1,000 questions by media. Not one member of the media has ever come up to me and said, Bernie, what are you going to do to deal with the outrage of America having the most unfair distribution of wealth of any country on earth? What are you going to do about it? Have you ever heard any political leader ever being asked that question? Why not? Why is that issue outside of the scope of what we are allowed to talk about.
Independent Senator Bernie Sanders of Vermont speaking at the National Conference for Media Reform. It took place last weekend in Memphis, Tennessee. One of the other featured speakers was veteran White House correspondent Helen Thomas, commonly referred to as the First Lady of the Press. Thomas is the most senior member of the White House press corps, has covered every president since John F. Kennedy. Thomas has been a leading critic of the Bush administration and of the press corps during the lead-up to the Iraq invasion. Her new book is called Watchdogs of Democracy, The Waning Washington Press Corps and How It's Failed the Public. Well, on March 21, 2006, Thomas was called upon directly by President Bush for the first time at one of his news conferences in 3 years. Thomas asked him about Iraq.
I'd like to ask you, Mr. President, your decision to invade Iraq has caused the deaths of thousands of Americans and Iraqis, wounds of Americans and Iraqis for a lifetime. Every reason given, publicly at least, has turned out not to be true. My question is, why did you really want to go to war? Mm-hmm. From the moment you stepped into the White House, yeah. From your cabinet, former cabinet officers, intelligent people, and so forth. Mm-hmm. What was your real reason? You have said it wasn't oil, quest for oil. It hasn't been Israel or anything else. What was it?
I think your premise, and all due respect to your question and to you as a lifelong journalist, is that, you know, I didn't want war. To assume I wanted war is just flat wrong, Helen, in all due respect. No, hold on for a second, please. Excuse me. No president wants war. Everything you may have heard is that, but it's just simply not true. My attitude about the defense of this country changed on September the 11th. When we got attacked, I vowed then and there to use every asset at my disposal to protect the American people. Our foreign policy changed on that day, Helen. You know, we used to think we were secure because of oceans and previous diplomacy, but we realized on September 11, 2001, that killers could destroy innocent life. And I'm never going to forget it. And I'm never going to forget the vow I made to the American people that we will do everything in our power to protect our people. Part of that meant to make sure that we didn't allow people to provide safe haven to an enemy, and that's why I went into Iraq. Hold on for a second. Excuse me for a second. They did. The Taliban provided safe haven for al-Qaeda. That's where al-Qaeda trained and... Helen, excuse me.
And so it went. President Bush being questioned by Helen Thomas at the news conference last March. Well, Democracy Now! Caught up with Helen Thomas at the Media Reform Conference in Memphis. I began by asking her about President Bush's recent primetime address to the nation from the White House library, where he vowed to send more troops to Iraq.
Well, I don't think I'll be unique in saying it escalates the war, obviously. To send more troops in is a debacle. Last year, they were talking about drawing down. I just think it's a tragedy.
Condoleezza Rice said it's not an escalation, it's an augmentation.
Euphemisms have marked this administration. They're great at it. Nothing is real.
You have covered many presidents, and you have covered a number of wars.
On the sidelines. I haven't been to war itself.
Administration policy from the White House
Washington,
perspective,
right.
From Washington.
So I don't feel very brave about it.
But how does this compare? Does it bring back any memories of other wars?
It's deja vu all over again with Vietnam, except the difference is our passive society. At least during Vietnam, they hit the streets. The people hit the streets finally when they realized there had been deception, and it was a no-go. Too many, we were killing people 10,000 miles away, and the reason could not be explained, except the domino theory, which was fading. In this case, I think that because every home isn't really affected, you don't have that same kind of... But I'll tell you this, I do think that the president's speech was a turning point. All the broadcasters, mainstream, were calling it the last chance. I call it really, I don't think the president expected that the people, the polls, Congress, would line up against it as they have. And it's a groundswell, really. It's a big change.
You talked about euphemisms. What about the word surge? The word surge?
I never have used it. I have never used it in my copy. Escalation is more apropos.
Also in that library address, and actually before I ask you the question, I want to ask, what about his going to the White House library? What is the significance of this?
I don't know. I think that there's staging in all for all presidential addresses. They try to think what will project, and I think what they were trying to project is this is a man who is intellectual, he reads, and so forth. What do books personify? But I think that was the message, that he does read Shakespeare, Camus, or whatever. But does anything get home?
Your last question to President Bush wasn't it more than a half a year ago?
Right.
March, maybe, of 2006.
It's almost a year.
And you asked about his real reason for going to war. Can you repeat the question and why you asked it and respond
sure,
to his
I think,
response?
The astounding thing, if you were in a room with many people and you went to 10 people and asked them why we're in this war, you'd get 10 different answers. And that's no way to go to war. So I asked the president, what is the real reason, when every reason turned out to be untrue? Weapons of mass destruction, no. Ties to Al-Qaeda, no. A threat from a third world country, no. To the world's only military superpower. So I asked him, what was his real reason? And then he said, the Taliban. I said, I'm talking about Iraq, Mr. President. Then he said, 9/11. I said, but the Iraqis had nothing to do with 9/11. And on it went. The thing is, I certainly didn't get a clear-cut answer. It isn't for me, it's for the world, it's for the country. Why are you being asked to die? What is the valid reason? There are reasons. We have been in wars that I think people feel there was the right cause, certainly World War II. But to send people to war and that and under what pretenses now? Now it's nuclear war, I think, in terms of Iran.
In fact, on the issue of Iran, that was a key part of President Bush's library speech, was being extremely aggressive about Iran and Syria. Can you talk about that?
Well, I think that he should talk to them, as the Iraq Study Group said. And I think we should keep talking, jaw-jaw, not war-war. This is what Churchill said. No, I mean, why would you not talk? Why would you not use every resource, every resort to keep from war, keep from killing?
Well, why do you think he would not use every possible option before war?
I think he still thinks that he can call the shots in terms of preemptive war in our power. Somebody seems to have, or he's convinced himself, that his legacy to go down in history of having saved the world. Well, I think that won't be his legacy. He also is identifying with Truman, very courageous moves. But he's out there alone. It's lonely at the top, and I think he doesn't realize. I'm sure he must be quite shocked, maybe I'm wrong, at the opposition that he's facing now from all sides, the polls, the people, the Congress. Congressional leaders he would automatically expect to be with him. There are a handful of Republican leaders who are with him, but they don't seem as enthusiastic as they have been in the past. I mean, there's McCain, there's Lindsey Graham, and a few others, Lieberman, who's independent.
Can you talk about the significance of his rejection of the Baker-Iraq Study Group and the significance of who Baker is in George Bush's world, George W. Bush?
Well, he certainly represented the president's father's realm. And he certainly is a man who is an experience as a politician. He was Secretary of State, he was Secretary of Treasury, and so forth. I think he was sent in, really, basically, by at least his father's friends to try to see if there could be some sort of last chance to pull the president out of this hole. And he slammed the door.
What was President Bush, George W. Bush, what was the message he was sending back to his dad?
Well, he would deny any message. I mean, he publicly always wholeheartedly supports his son. And that's about as natural as it can ever be. You always do that, that's family. But I think, and I have not spoken to him, I don't think he wants to speak to me either. But I just have an idea that the way he ran things, of course, were totally different. And I think he knows in his heart, got to know, that this is wrong.
We'll return to my interview with veteran White House correspondent Helen Thomas in a minute. Davis, Election Day here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. As we return to veteran White House correspondent Helen Thomas, who's covered the White House for, well, more than 57 years. I was interviewing her at the National Conference for Media Reform in Memphis, Tennessee. Helen Thomas, former President Jimmy Carter just wrote a new book called Palestine, Peace, Not Apartheid. Can you talk about the significance of this book and also the reaction to it? You covered Jimmy Carter as president.
I did, and I think he's certainly President Carter. I believe he is. He has credibility. He has faith in humanity. He's trying to do the right thing. He's trying to tell the other side of the story, and I don't think the Palestinian side has ever been told in the way that people might accept it. So I think he's done a good thing. I think obviously the reaction to the book by the Israelis, some Israelis, but probably not all, that's understandable. But he's out there, it's open for debate, and I think he's started a good trend.
How do you think the Palestinian story should be told for people in this country
to understand? Truthfully, from the beginning. If you were a Palestinian, and they were 85% in the majority when the British decided that that could be the Jewish homeland, I mean, what would you think? Americans have to put themselves in other people's positions. Put yourself in Iraqi. I mean, we invade a country without any cause because it was there.
This you're talking about Iraq.
Well, I'm talking about being able to do what you think it's prudent. It was British had no right to give. It was part of the Ottoman Empire. Ottoman Empire was falling apart. They didn't own Palestine. They got a mandate through the League of Nations, but they have no right to give it away. They also had no right, really, to annex Jerusalem, because the UN had voted, actually, not in that direction, and it's still, you know, up in the air. I think there is a settlement. I do think there are two countries there, and they could live side by side. And I'll bet you, when there is real peace, they will be hugging each other. And I mean, they are so close to each other, really. Having lived through wars, World War II, we friends, Japanese and Germans are good friends. Vietnam, good friends, and so forth. What is this? Why do we have to fight? Why can't we talk to each other and understand each other?
President Carter, in interviews since his book came out, did talk about the power of APEC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. What about the scope of debate on this issue in the United States, in the U.S. press,
among your colleagues? I think the fact that it's starting up is good. Good. People should hear both sides of the story.
But do we hear it in the United States? Do we hear it in the United States? I mean, some say that the scope of the debate here is more narrow than it is in Israel, in the press there.
I think that's probably true. I think that since World War II, it's that if you took a position against Israel, they were automatically, you'd be labeled anti-Semitic. I'm more Semitic than the most journalists I know. So, but this is the way they go around branding you. You get branded because, I mean, if you take an opposite position to Israel, you will be automatically be considered anti-Semitic. I mean, there are solutions to this. I mean, there are great peace groups in Israel and Palestine and so forth. People are trying.
President Ford recently died. Talk about his tenure, the significance of his pardon of Nixon, and the questions you asked Ford. They were repeated over and over again in the last few weeks.
Fame at last. Well, I think that he made a great contribution by really giving a new sense of confidence to the Oval Office, security in the nation after the unraveling of the Watergate scandal, and the trauma that everyone felt afterwards. Who can you trust? Trusting the government and so forth. I think he brought in this good old, let's call it Midwestern, sense of belonging. And people felt very comfortable about that. I think the pardon hurt him, obviously. It came too soon. It was the timing. Left too much suspicion. And it was 1 month almost to the day after. And so I had my first question to him at a news conference, his first news conference, 2 weeks after he had taken office and said the long national nightmare was over. I asked him if he was going to follow the judicial process or pardon. But and I misinterpreted totally. I thought he would, Paul, at least. That, you know, if that had played out. But as time goes on, all things are forgivable, I guess.
But could you envision a world where the process had been carried out, either of impeachment or actual criminal prosecution of President Nixon? What would that world look like today when talking about accountability?
I mean, in the crassest way, it would show that no president is above the law.
Instead, the way the media framed it, even those who were very opposed to the pardon at the time, the media, after President Ford died, everyone was saying, upon reflection, I was wrong.
Well, I never said I was wrong. I thought it should probably go through the court process. But that's over and done with, and I know the pain it caused, but look, President Clinton didn't know 1 second for 8 years in the White House when he was not being impeached by all of the forged friends, probably. I mean, it was excruciating. I don't know how the man stood it. 8 years, not 1 second. They denied him legitimacy, and he took it. And he took it like a man, he really did.
For young journalists.
Or like a president should, maybe.
For young journalists watching you ask tough questions, and comparing that to the kind of questions that most of the White House press corps, and I know they're your friends, ask, for example, in the lead up to the invasion. It's very different now. They're asking some questions.
They're coming out of the coma. Thank goodness.
Well, what caused the coma?
I think Katrina, they were unleashed. They really began to understand their role, to question the president, to question the way things went. And they were allowed, it seemed, from the powers that be, whoever controls, to show more emotion and so forth. I think in the run-up to the war, there was the fear card was played very well, and reporters were afraid of being called un-American, unpatriotic. I know I've told you this 50,000 times, but I think that they got more courage, and it was a less critical question. Katrina was there, and everybody could see it, and they knew something was terribly wrong.
Compare your questions before the invasion in the lead-up to your colleagues' questions.
I wish they had piled on more. I honestly believe that if the press had really said, why? Give us the proof. And that Congress, too. Congress rolled over and played dead as well. I honestly believe that there might have been a chance to avoid this debacle of killing.
Would you say that the way the press corps operates is they will cover the spectrum of debate between the Democrats and Republicans? And when that's almost nil, like in the lead up to the invasion, Democrats voted with the Republicans for authorizing the war, then the press doesn't go further, even if the American people have gone far further.
Well, you know, when you speak of the press, of course, you have to speak of different segments of the press. Reporters, straight reporters, wire service, you stick to the facts. You don't create the story, per se. You cover what is happening. In terms of opinion, and then you have the spectrum of that. And I think that we do drop the ball in terms of everything has to be current, and there's no backtracking. Certainly, I think this administration is very happy. Nobody's going back to say, how did we get into this? You don't see any story saying, we invaded Iraq. That's why we're there. No, that's past history, right? We just go on. Now, the new alliance euphemism is the path forward. And so, forward from what? So, none of these stories really give you some sense that of perspective of the wise.
What do you think has to happen right now?
Pull out of Iraq.
Today.
Sure.
What would it mean?
It wouldn't mean any more the killing. I mean, the match has been struck across the whole Middle East. You've got to try to put out these fires, and you start by, getting out. You have any? I don't know whether the Iraqis have the Iraqis spoken yet.
It sounds like they are not saying what President Bush did—that they are in accord with this.
No. Well, why would they be? Who wants? I mean, we get this mythology every day of how sovereign Iraq is now. You can't be a sovereign with an American soldier on every corner. Is that sovereign? Occupying forests.
Much of the press says Congress doesn't really play a role here. This is the president's war. What could Congress do?
Well, I don't think they're going to cut off funding, which they probably could. They could leave money in the pipeline, as Kucinich wants, just to bring them home. I don't think that's going to happen because they'll be accused of letting the troops down. And so Congress can take a stand and say, we've got to get out, and we've got to get out at least within the next 6 months, could be gradual and everything, and this whole business, how ungrateful the Iraqis are. By God, they won't do exactly what we want them to do. They don't shape up. They don't understand democracy. And so what is this, blaming the Iraqis? You go in, you destroy a country, you kill thousands, tens of thousands of their people, and now you say, they don't understand. We did them a big favor, the Grateful Dead.
Helen Thomas, President Ford said in 1975 at the White House Correspondents' Dinner, if God had created the world in 6 days, he could not have rested. He would have had to explain it to Helen Thomas.
And I would have been asking why. My favorite question.
Why is that so
important? You're getting me into a lot of trouble.
In what way?
I'm too wound up.
What do you say to your colleagues?
I don't say anything to them. They hear me loud and clear when I'm questioning Tony Snow or someone else.
What is your assessment of Tony Snow, the man who came from Fox?
I think he's well meant, but I think he's very slick, very smooth. And he's walking the line in lockstep with everyone else.
What is the relationship?
In the administration.
What is the relationship of the White House correspondence with the White House? Is there a protocol that you would criticize there?
I don't understand.
The relationship, the kind of understanding between the White House press corps and the president, a kind of...
Well, I think they tolerate us. I mean, I think that we're the necessary evil in that respect. And they do hold, I mean, Tony Snow does hold regular briefings and so forth. They know they have to be answerable. They know they have to be accountable. I mean, every president has to be.
But does the press hold them accountable? I mean...
Not in my opinion, not enough. And they should press for more news conferences, obviously. The news conference, presidential news conference, is the only forum in our society where a president can be questioned on a regular basis and held accountable. That's why we should have more and ask him why, the whys. That's the only way the democracy works. We have to understand what we're doing and why.
When does President Bush hold a news conference?
Well, he's been holding more this year, actually. On his own terms, but I think there's no real, I never hear a big clamor for a news conference, and there should be.
What can the journalists do? What do you mean when you say they should clamor for it?
More and more reporters ask Tony Snow every day, why aren't we holding a news conference? It would come home. It gets to them, finally. I've seen it happen, even in the most hard-shell administrations. At some point, there's a public pressure. And that's what we should have done in the run-up to the war.
The story of big media, that's the topic of this conference of thousands of people in these few days, of holding big media accountable. What is your take on that?
I mean, you...
What is big media?
The handful of media moguls that own most of the networks and the press outlets in this country.
I'd tell them, forget about all those profits and help the country. That the media should be a public service. You cannot have a democracy without an informed people. And that should be their role. They can make their money everywhere else.
Veteran White House correspondent Helen Thomas. She's covered the White House for 57 years. We spoke to her in Memphis at the National Conference for Media Reform. If you'd like a copy of today's show, you can go to our website at democracynow.org. On Thursday, January 25th, I'll be at Cooper Union with Deepa Fernandez talking about her new book, Targeted, Homeland Security and the Business of Immigration. Democracy Now! Is produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdo-Kaddous, John Hamilton, Elizabeth Press, Yoruba Rich and Aramate, Lee Burek, Jen Yutz, Anna Nagara, and Anuradha Bhagwati. Mike DeFilippo, Miguel Nagara, our engineers. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.